They say that dogs are our best friends. But maybe they're more than that. Hi, I'm Suzanne Lang with a novel idea. The tragic death of a beloved dog, the lifeline of a new one, and the finding of home, with all its trip-ups and rewards, is the territory of Jane Vandenberg's book, The Wrong Dog Dream, A True Romance. We'll talk with Jane a little later in the broadcast, but first we talk about the power of Dalmatians. Linda Gray Sexton, daughter of poet Anne Sexton, was 9 years old when her family got its first Dalmatian, and 37 Dals later, we have Sexton's latest memoir, Bespotted, My Family's Love Affair with 38 Dalmatians. So stay with us. It's KRCB's A Novel Idea. One winter's morning when she was just about 13, Linda Gray Sexton witnessed her first births of a little litter of Dalmatians. It was this episode that inspired her mother, poet Anne Sexton, to write the poem Live, the final entry in her Pulitzer Prize-winning volume, Live or Die. Anne Sexton, whose confessional poetry was groundbreaking at the time, suffered from mental illness, and during her life, her family experienced her many suicide attempts. And in the midst of this, it was their dogs, these Dalmatians, that seemed to brighten her or hearten her. Linda and her mother had a complex relationship, made no less so by Anne's ultimate death from suicide when Linda was 21. Linda became the literary executor of her mother's estate and has gone on to write 4 novels and 2 other unabashed memoirs, Searching for Mercy Street, My Journey Back to My Mother Anne Sexton, and Half in Love, Surviving the Legacy of Suicide. Let's listen now to my conversation with Linda Gray Sexton. Bespotted, My Family's Love Affair with 38 Dalmatians. It's your 3rd memoir, and your first being Searching for Mercy Street, The Journey Back to My Mother, Anne Sexton, which you wrote around, I think you were probably around 40, and that dealt really with that complex relationship between you and your mom. Then followed that with your 2nd memoir, Half in Love, Surviving the Legacy of Suicide, which really dealt in a very candid way with your own challenges with depression and your suicide attempts. And now, a little bit later in your life, you've written Bespotted, that talks about some of the same things, and certainly you mentioned Dalmatians in these other 2 books. But now this book feels like it's coming from a different perspective in your own life. So I certainly want to talk about dogs and about Bespotted in particular. But I'm interested in this whole trajectory from Searching for Mercy Street to Bespotted and your personal migration that brought you to write this particular memoir.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, you start out writing one, and that's all you know. And then another one comes to you. And then another one comes to you. And they do follow in a linear sense. I think of Half in Love as being a sequel, in a way, not entirely, but in a way, to Searching for Mercy Street. Because some of the same questions are raised, but from a much more personal point of view in terms of my own mental illness, not just my mother's mental illness, which is what Searching for Mercy Street covers more fully. And Searching for Mercy Street is really a journey about forgiveness. Half in Love might be also a journey about forgiveness, forgiving myself for having tried to commit suicide, having inherited this legacy, as I call it, which then affects my children. So one book covers one territory, the other book covers the other, but they're linked. Bespotted, the third, really takes a whole new look at my family, my childhood, my adulthood, and it's a very positive. The other books were quite dark, and this book is a lot lighter. It really delves into the relationships in my families, both my childhood families and my adult families, with my children and my husband and my ex-husband. So it covers the same period of time, but it's from a different perspective. It's from the perspective of happiness and joy and learning to take pleasure in the variety of things that happened to me as I went along the way, as opposed to being more focused on the darker aspects of my life. This is focused on the lighter aspects of my life. And I think it was possible because I came to a new place in my life where mental illness had receded into the background, suicide attempts were gone, I'm really well medicated on bipolar drugs, I have a great therapist, I have a great husband, I have great dogs.
And, you know, that's what was so really fascinating to me, that you talk about a lot of the same instances and episodes, yet as your evolving sensibility and mental health changes, by the time we get to Bespotted, it's just through a different lens. Because certainly in the first two memoirs, you mention your dogs and you get a sense of their importance. But in this latest book, you really foreground them a lot. I think lest our readers think this is a less weighty book, I think you put it well that it's brighter. But it does deal with a lot of challenging issues as well. And I think that you are a very candid writer, and you don't shy away from dealing with the reality of any situation. But from the very beginning of your life with Dalmatians as a child, hard lessons of loss and love came with those relationships with your dogs. There was not just that wonderful birth of puppies that so inspired your mother, but also the untimely death of those early dogs from either a car accident or euthanasia. And definitely that whole idea of euthanizing animals is something you address. And it's something if you own a pet, it's something many of us face. And those issues of loss and love are universal as well. So talk a little bit about those lessons that these relationships with animals have given you.
Well, first let me say that I'm a candid writer. I thought that was a great way to put it, because I grew up in the home of a writer whose motto was, and what she said to me always, tell it true, tell the whole truth.
And you do. I think it's so amazing in your books that you get smelly when you need to get smelly, and talking about animals, that is the case. But you also achieve or have a style that it almost feels like you're sitting down and talking to the reader.
Well, I'd like to invite a reader into my life. That's the whole purpose to me of writing a memoir. And you have to reveal yourself to do that, of course. In Bespotted, you asked about the lessons we learn from animals, and I talk about how our dogs were really therapy dogs in so many ways. They brought us laughter. They helped us to live a life which was sometimes marred by my mother's depression, my father's anger. And then later in my life, I had a very, very special Dalmatian who saw me through my own depression, my own suicide attempts, and really made my life possible until I was able to take hold of it again myself. He was really instrumental in my staying alive. And a lot of people would say, well, how can a dog do that? And that's one of the things I wanted to talk about in the book. I wanted people to understand that a dog can really mean that much to you, more than just a pet, but a central part of your life. And I think this is true for many people. You know, dogs, cats, whatever the pet may be, they are like children to us. And actually, there's an interesting statistic that says there are more dogs in American households than there are children, which I found amazing when I read it. That just seemed incredible to me. But I think, you know, I move through the way these dogs taught us so many things. Yes, of course, it has to deal with loss, because when you lose someone you love, be it dog or person, you go through a grieving process. And euthanasia today, when we lost our early dogs when I was a child to euthanasia, it was in old age or, in one case, a deaf dog. And that was the fashion then, to put a deaf dog down. But today, euthanasia is so different for us because so many things are possible for our animals. There are specialists. There are cancer specialists. There are internal medicine specialists. We have a whole array of possibilities for prolonging the life of our animals. And we're in a new position now. We have to be their voices to make the decision that enough is enough. You know, there's always more you can do. And at some point you have to say, what's the quality of life here? And I have to take it upon myself to make the decision for them.
And it seems like that was the challenge that you articulate quite well in the book. Here you had this dog, Gulliver, that you said, you say about dogs that they set you free in love. And certainly that dog, he had a physical presence in your life that provided you with comfort and stability. I think I would be accurate to say that. Yet you had to make a very tough call at the end of his life.
Yeah, we were given two alternatives. He was very, very sick, and he had gotten sick quite suddenly, so we weren't prepared. I had always thought that he would live to a very old, old age. Dals sometimes live to be 15, and I had imagined that he would live to have an old age, and I would have to euthanize. If I had to euthanize him, it would be at the end of his life. What happened instead was he got very ill when he was 12. And we were faced with a decision either to pursue the mystery of what was wrong, because they couldn't identify what was wrong, to have surgery to identify what was wrong, or to let him go. And it took us a good 3 hours to figure it out in a crisis situation. We were sitting with him. He was growing progressively worse, and it was killing me. I'm sorry.
That's okay, because when I was reading that part of the book, I was, here we're going to both be reduced to tears here. I was bawling my eyes out.
It's hard for me to talk about it without crying.
So I think we'll take a turn here then, because I think that's not an uncommon relation that we have with our animals, and that is a reality we face, but it's something we sometimes don't legitimize or give credibility to in each other. You lost your dog. And you, in your book, say that that was the greatest loss of your life.
Well, you know, if you have a very strong bond with a particular animal, you find that you're given so much love, so much joy. That's what they bring you, and it's their gift to you. And so you owe them, at the end, a gift of making a right decision. not making a decision for yourself, which, you know, for many people is to prolong because there are all these, you know, procedures and medications and everything available to us that didn't used to be. This is a new frontier in animal medicine, what we can do now. I have an epileptic dog right now. He's only 2 years old. We did an MRI. We did a spinal tap, trying to determine the cause of the epilepsy. Was there a brain tumor? Was it idiopathic, which means for no reason? And we've gone through a really hard time with his seizures. Now he's been stabilized. He's not having the seizures anymore. And there was never any question of euthanizing him. But we had all these options available to us. And that is also true at the end of an animal's life, the options that are available. And I believe and counsel my friends who are trapped in the, I can't let him or her go. I can't bear it. It's too hard for me. And that's not the right answer, in my opinion. The right answer is, what is right for this being who has given you unstintingly through his or her life?
You talk a lot in the book about whelping, which I guess is the whole process of birthing dog babies.
That's right.
And especially with Dalmatians, it seems like from your first whelping as a child, where your dog was giving birth to a litter next to the kitty litter box, to this last litter that you describe in the book, at least, where the dog had a cesarean to have these puppies, and you describe all the kind of tests that the puppies have before you place and stuff like that. So that is really quite a journey you made as well in your ability to being a mom to puppies.
Sure. The birthing process, which is called whelping, is just magical. You know, you have a dog who really knows what she's meant to do. To some extent, you sit at the sidelines, but you help a little bit, depending on how much she will tolerate. And it's miraculous to me, the instinct they have to do it the right way, and yet, at the same time, an accepting girl will really take you into the experience, and that's what my experience has been. The dog that had the cesarean section had a premature labor, and we were monitoring that very carefully with a contraction belt that went around her tummy every day for 2 weeks. She had to lie very still for an entire hour. She couldn't move, and we measured the contractions and were able with medication to not lose the litter. So that was a pretty amazing experience, and we bonded very tightly over that. And it was sad to me that we had to have a cesarean section because, you know, life arriving is magical. I did stand outside the surgical suite, which had a huge picture window, so I was able to witness the birth, but it wasn't the same thing as having my hands on the babies. On the other hand, as soon as they're born and the team works on them to, you know, suction the fluid out of their lungs and really get them going so they're, you know, crying, the same way when a woman is giving birth, the nurses take the baby and get them going and you hear that first cry and then the baby is given back to the mother. So we give the In a cesarean section, we give the puppies back to the mom and get them suckling right away. And the mom, in my case, she was just great. She accepted them right away, even though she hadn't actually, you know, birthed them herself. She'd been unconscious while they did this. And now suddenly here were these little beings. And yet instinct takes over again, and she right away begins to nurse them, to care for them, to clean them, all those things. So for me, even with the cesarean section, having puppies was just the most joyous thing in the world. And I wish I could have, you know, a litter every minute. But, you know, if you're a responsible breeder, you just don't have litter after litter after litter because you want to take your time, you know. And I am not the kind of person who has a dog, and then when the dog becomes older, like the girl I have now who was here for the litters that we had, I'm not about to place her somewhere just because she's 6 years old and that's too old to have a litter. I have to wait now until another girl comes into my home and we're able to breed her. So, you know, the dogs are really a part of our life. They don't live outside in a kennel. They live in the house with us. And, you know, they're really integral to the way we work and live and love.
The final sentence of your book is, once again, a Dalmatian had taught me absolutely everything I needed to know. And I think that is a good way to sum up this book, Bespotted, My Family's Love Affair with 38 Dalmatians. And Linda, you also, in your past, have written, I think, maybe four novels. Mm-hmm. It seems to me I read someplace that you might be thinking about writing another novel, or are you going to continue writing memoirs until you drop?
Well, of course you have to have something to say in order to write a memoir about your own life. And right now, I don't think I have anything to say about my own life that would really contribute to a memoir. So, in any case, I decided it would be time to take a break and return to fiction. So I am working on a novel right now. Not too far into it because I've been interrupted with all the publicity for Bespotted and everything going on around it. But I expect once all that dies down, I'll be able to go back to work and really, you know, dig down deep to work on this fiction. Fiction is so different than memoir because you get to create whatever you want, characters, plot line, you know, you get to make it up. Memoir, you don't make up. In some ways, it can be easier because it follows the path of your life and you know your life better than anyone else. But on the other hand, you don't have the freedom to say, well, you know, I really didn't like how this was going, so I just altered it. You have to stick to truth, which is more subjective, but nothing like the creation of a novel. A novel's just totally different.
I would think that a memoir is you're living with yourself in your own world and trying to be honest, probing about that, which takes a wholly different kind of energy than being steeped in other people's lives, fictional lives, on a daily basis, and probably distracts you in a different way, and maybe is more enjoyable. I don't know.
I don't know. I love writing memoir. I really love it, and I find it, for me, it's easier, even though it requires delving deeply into your own life and into your psyche and into the things which have happened to you if you want to have something useful to say. Even though that is true and that makes it a little easier, as I say, fiction gives you the freedom to create different things. Yet, even with fiction for me, I want to delve into people, the way they think. You know, I don't write novels that are just plot lines. I write character-driven novels. So I find myself in all the characters in one way or another, you know. So it's a different use of my sensibilities, my experiences, and the life that I've had. It's just not based around me. It's the creation of other characters, but it uses the things that I feel. Because if I don't feel strongly about it, then I don't write it very well.
Well, I want to thank you for your time today and encourage our listeners and readers to pick up Bespotted. And I think that if readers pick up Be Spotted and read it, it will lead them directly to your other memoirs as well. I think as a trilogy almost, it's there, each one have a different story to tell. And I have to say thank you, Linda, for being so honest and candid, because you have a unique life and some of what you have experienced in your life is extraordinary, and some of it touches on what we all experience, and I think we can learn a lot from what you have to share.
Well, thank you for having me. It's always such a pleasure to speak with someone who's actually read the books and knows what she's talking about, because really all I'm doing is reaching out to people and saying, I've been there too. I understand how you feel. This is my life, but parts of it are your life too.
Linda Gray Sexton on her book, Be Spotted. We'll take a short break, and when we return, we'll visit with Jane Vandenberg on her book, The Wrong Dog Dream. These authors couldn't be more different, except for the fact that they openly write about their lives and the central role animals play in their equilibrium, in their love, in their creativity. Let's listen to a song in tribute to all of our wonderful pets, dogs, cats, even rabbits. We'll be right back.
I love you like the earth. I love you like the rain. I love you like the sun coming up again. And the moon pulling on the tide. And the day turning into night. I love you like the trees. Love you like the wind. Love you like the sun coming. Air when the day is gone. I love you like the earth. I love you like the sky on a sunny day. Love you like the stars in the Milky Way. And the lake when a mist rolls in. And the clouds floating on the wind. I love you like a storm. Love you like the sea. Love you like the birds. Love you like the earth, like the moon and like the sun, the universe and I are one, the world green and blue, the beauty of it all is you. I love you like the earth, love you like the hills, love you like time when it all stands still. Road that will take me home to the sweetest love I have known. I love you like the years, love you like the space, love you like the lines written on your face. And the moon pulling on the tide, and the day turning into night, and the sun coming up again. I love you like the earth.
That was Audrey Auld Mazera and Nina Gerber with Love You Like the Earth from the album In the House. This is KRCB's A Novel Idea. Jane Vandenberg is the author of several books of fiction and nonfiction and blogs for the Huffington Post. I spoke with her last year and found our conversation interesting in light of Linda Gray Sexton's book and life as a writer. So let's listen to my conversation with Jane Vandenberg. We're here today to talk about The Wrong Dog Dream, your latest book, a memoir, and a true romance.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll get to that in a minute, but some of our readers might not be familiar with your other work, and you have two works of fiction, two novels, Failure to Zigzag and The Physics of Sunset.
Right.
And then you've moved into the realm of nonfiction.
My first memoir is called A Pocket History of Sex in the 20th Century, a memoir. And I'm very proud of the title because it's actually about gender.
Uh-huh. And that explored a different period of your life than this one.
Yes. Yes. This book is the book that I was told I'd left out of the memoir. So I see it actually as three parts of one greater work, and actually all my work as the same story. I just tell it from different rooms of the same big house.
And I just quickly want to mention your book, The Architecture of the Novel, that seems to be a tool for other writers. And we live in the Bay Area, which, you know, every third house or fourth house is a writer, and in between there's maybe a poet, you know,
yeah,
and a painter yeah next door. What prompted you to go in that direction of writing that kind of book?
I teach the longer narrative. I teach a year-long course in writing a book. I can teach almost anybody to write a novel. I think poets are born. I think they're born with a beautiful voice. And if you don't have one, and I'm sorry to say I do not, I am not a poet. And every once in a while I accidentally write one, but a poem. But I'm not a poet, nor am I a short story writer. I came through an MFA program or an MA program where we were all being encouraged to write short things. Every little story of mine was like a broken novel. And that, I think, is something that's quite innate in us, that rhythm, whether the story is large or whether it's small and elegant. And I think about this a whole lot. I think it's very hard to write a very beautiful and perfect short story. I have never done so. I never will. And that those who have that particular gift are special among us. But on the other hand, storytelling is so natural to us that you give me a person and I can get a novel out of them. I know it. It doesn't take much talent. It's really the trash can of genres. We put everything in there, recipes and footnotes and everything left over from and vengeance. It's a wonderful form and it's enormous.
And more writers are writing memoir out of that same storytelling drive, that really we have the material right here.
Oh, yeah. And it feels to me like this is actually a very important task, that if we don't in some way or another get a hold of the narrative and become the subject of the sentence, especially maybe for women, especially, that we then are turned into the direct object where we feel like life happens to us and we're not the one really in charge and we're not driving the car. The vehicle has run us over somehow. And so if there's anything about which I feel sort of messianic, it is this, that we do have these stories. It is extremely important for us to tell them. And that the storytelling thing, there is no trick really to writing a novel. You just make these scenes and then you put them in the order that the story demands. And it is so simple. That's why I can teach anybody to do it. And I know that because I taught myself how to do it out of this huge morass. As you may have guessed, I don't have any problem like with writer's block. I have the other problem, which is that I have sort of the accelerated need to handle everything in language. It's what I do with trauma. And so in the case of The Wrong Dog Dream, this horror happened to us that my husband and I, we as a family had got a puppy, and he and I both obsessed about losing this dog. It was very odd because he's a very calm person and a Buddhist, and I'm anxious by nature. But he was very anxious about losing our dog also, and it was a time of great displacement. We had moved all the way across the country, and our kids were back and forth, and our kids were in California. And so we'd put all this stuff, this burden of worry, onto our dog. And we worried about leaving him in boarding, and yet we needed to because we were back and forth to California all the time, and our dog died in boarding. And the horror of exactly what each of us had worried about and happened, that usually you believe, I'm, you know, an agnostic at least, and we think that if we worry about something that that sort of protects us, like works like prayer used to, but it hadn't protected our dog. And we were just blown down by this. So we did the thing that you're not supposed to do and that people got extremely mad at us for doing, which was 4 days later, our dog died on Monday. And by Saturday afternoon, we had a new dog named Wayne Tebow. And our first dog was beautiful, and our second dog is frankly funny looking. And we got him in West Virginia, and we got him from the pound. He's a West Virginia porch hound, which means long legs like a greyhound, and whatever cross between whatever you have, they say, and whatever comes up on your porch.
In contrast to your dog that died on boarding, Whistler, that was a high-end pedigree dog.
Right.
And when a pet dies, it seems like it renders everything into the past.
Mm-hmm.
It's a demarcation.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know why it feels even more so than when people die, maybe mm-hmm. because of the intimacy that we have with them. But mm-hmm. it seems that you need to start new. And it seems like you guys just did that. You did that.
Yeah, Jack knew how to do that. I mean, he knew how to get out of bed and go get in the car and drive to go get the dog. We had to talk them into giving us a dog. We were so messed up that we couldn't stay out of bed. I mean, it was really unbelievably devastating. I dealt with the deaths of both my parents. I'd watched and been with him as he dealt with the deaths, the loss of his parents. But for some reason, the purity of that loss and that it was absolute negligence and that I'd picked the kennel, and so my terrible guilt about this, you know, misjudgment of this person that we left our dog in the care of, and that it was preventable, and there was just a purity of sadness and terror and loss that really absolutely blew both of us down, which was really surprising to me because I knew I would go to bed over something. I mean, I'd go to bed over something for 3 days. But Jack, too. I mean, he also just could not manage until so we explained to the ladies at the kennel, and we had to talk them into giving us this dog, because if we had a dog, then we'd have to stay out of bed and go walk our dog and take care of him. So they gave us our dog for $45.
And this might be a good time to set up the wrong dog dream that you opened the book with.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to read from it?
Sure, I'd be happy to. Someone in my family dreamed it. No one now remembers who. The dream stems from something that happened when we were living in the East, and so begins in what feels solidly fact-based and actual. Just back from a visit to Berkeley, we are stopping by the vets to pick up our dog from boarding. We are all there, my husband, my daughter, my son, and me, all in that state of high alert known as hypervigilance, all watching the door in the back of the waiting room. This is where the tech will appear, bringing our dog to us. But here the dreamscape warps, time tilts, everything starts to take too long, door opening, families standing, brought into slow-mo unison by their crazy love for this dog, an English Springer Spaniel named Whistler. Now, as the dog is being led by the tech across the broad expanse of tile floor, the dreamer begins to get that something's a little off, that the two keep coming but remain very far away, that this family's fake, too loud, everyone saying false and scripted things. Hey, boy, there you are. We missed you, buddy. Come on. Come here. Good boy. Like they're all repeating lines of cartoon dialogue. Because this is not our dog. It only looks like him. A likeness in both appearance and behavior so uncanny that even the dog himself is fooled. As this dog, who is not our dog, comes wagging his no-tail rump at us, moving toward the strange family that now stands like a group of statues. Only the dreamer notices what no one else yet sees. That dog's a ringer. The dreamer wants to say, somehow knowing with a dreamer's spacious overview how the mix-up came to be, that two look-alike dogs so similar they might be clones have been switched in the back in grooming. This is the wrong dog, the dreamer tries to say aloud to the tech. Our real dog's the one in back, but the dreamer is frozen and can't seem to get the words out and so must struggle again to speak as the tech keeps leading the dog, who is not our dog, across the waiting room. The dreamer's now saying it more and more urgently. Wrong dog, wrong dog, but locked together in the paralysis of sleep, teeth, tongue, lips, all the muscles of the dreamer's face are stilled, so the words are slurred as they're said. Wrong dog, wrong dog. So no one pays attention, and the dreamer now understands the true horror here. What seemed to start as this loving, joyful dream has just become a nightmare.
Jane Vandenberg reading from her book, The Wrong Dog Dream. I found that in your book, it seemed like the death of Whistler was, whether you knew it at the time or not, a turning point in your own maybe view of your own life, as rather than creating this life, living this life.
Uh-huh.
And as your story progresses and your new dog comes into your life and your relationship is different with that dog, you have another episode in the book, and we don't want to give too much away. I want our readers to find out a lot. And I do want to say, I was nervous knowing that you were writing about the death of Whistler, and I was almost afraid to get to that part.
Mm-hmm.
And I will tell our readers that I thought you handled it in such a way that was tasteful, tactful, and spared the readers from feeling even more grief.
Yeah. Yeah, he dies. Our dog, the book is, I'm just looking at the pages, and he dies by page 70 or something. Because really, the book is about the fact that when we have animals, chances are we're going to outlive our animals. And it is so much like, I hate the analogy, but it is so much like losing a child. And yet we must learn how to deal with loss of our animals with dignity and to honor them and what they are. I mean, birth and death are very much part of our animal natures. And so our dogs remind us constantly that, I think I said in here, what kind we have these domesticated animals in our lives for a very profound purpose, which is that they remind us every single day of the necessity of being alive in the ways that they are, which is not in our minds. And as a writer, I can live up there, you know, to the point where I forget to eat or ever dress or leave the house. So having a dog for me is, it's like a physical necessity. And that this research into the way our domesticated animals function, in that they hold our gaze, the cat or the dog who lives in our house looks us in the eyes in the way that an animal in the wild will not. And so it was that special animal who came to us to live at that border between us and nature. And there are link backwards, so that when I go out with my dog on the trail, he shows me how to be there in a way I can't know without my animal. He sets the pace, and he's seeing and hearing and smelling, especially, so much more than I ever will. So, yeah, I think that this matter of learning to live the day that we're given is really the lesson that my dog has for me. And also his boundless. Oh, my God, this dog is so joyful. And he was a complete accident. And he is the funniest looking dog that you would ever see. He is not the beautiful planned perfect dog that we went and bought and researched and all that. We just happened upon this. A friend of mine used to call them junkyard dogs. And mm-hmm. yet he is just a magnificent creature. The other thing that a book does is it memorializes. So I always have Whistler now. You know, I have him as a little warm bundle of fur, and I have him as the neurotic little dog that, I mean, he really became a very neurotic, high-strung dog. And considering that we lived together in this house, he was living with this neurotic, sort of anxious, high-strung rider. And we'd walk out into this strange city in which we knew no one, and he would bark at anybody who looked to him at all peculiar. It was really a nightmare. I mean, he barked at people in wheelchairs. He barked at children in strollers. He didn't like little kids. He didn't like anybody who looked any bit different. If he saw a woman in a costume from Sierra Leone, he went just off his nut. And we are in the most cosmopolitan city in the nation. It was just a nightmare.
So we should tell our readers that in the book, you move from your home. I mean, you're a Bay Area native to the East Coast, to Washington, D.C., and then have a country place in West Virginia. And that's a big part of the story, too, is your life and living in these other areas. And as you move back to the Bay Area and have Tebow, your porch hound, you are dealing with creating a settled life here. And this book is very much, I think, a love story about you and your husband and the life you have together that, I don't know, maybe it took you by surprise.
That, well, it was surprising to me that I fell in love, you know. I mean, very lucky, very lucky. And I think that what happened with a childhood like mine, my dad was a suicide. My mother was crazy, really, frankly, and went to the mental hospital right after he died. And so I think that with that sort of childhood, typically you suffer this worry of that you'll ever be able to love anyone if you've lost those people. And I was, you know, well compensated. I was raised very well by my aunt and uncle, and I was very lucky. I was in a loving home, and was able to go ahead and go to college. And I was a hard worker and good student, and all that, and I could achieve. But that piece of really being swept away by falling in love was something that I had never experienced. I think because I was just too guarded. I just couldn't allow it. You know, I couldn't lose. I couldn't bear to lose. And I think that that was the reason, really, that Jack couldn't get a dog. He'd seen his dog hit by a car when he was a little boy and couldn't bear the thought. He's very, very good at being a loving person. I would say I'm not that good. He's also a very happy person. He's talented at it. And my first dog and I are the kind that have to work at it. Our second dog is a happy dog. And so these are our talents, and we can certainly benefit by being with somebody who is better at happiness, the practice of happiness, than you happen to be.
In your memoir, you talk about hiking and physical activity. Climbing a mountain is like writing a book. All it takes is the mind trick by which you hypnotize yourself into a state that's only suspension of negative belief. And that resonated so much with me personally, and I'm sure with other people too, that sometimes presenting ourselves with that kind of challenge really edifies us to do many other things. Mm-hmm. And it is just a matter of one foot in front of the other.
Right, right. Yeah. You can climb a mountain. And that's the way it's done. I think that we in our lives think I can't do that because the concept, it's the idea of climbing the mountain. It's not the reality. The reality is that it is simply one step. And that's exactly like writing a book. That's exactly why I can get people to write a book, because I can get them I can trick them into writing a scene. They don't have to write a chapter because chapter one is too hard to write anyway. You know, you don't start there. You start chapter seven anyway. But even chapters are too hard. So you just write a scene. And that's the way books are made.
Do you give writing workshops, Jan?
I do. I teach at a place called Fish Trap, and it's a beautiful writer's community and the northmost, eastmost part of Oregon. It's unbelievably remote. It takes forever to get there. But we meet in July for 7 days, and I get a batch of writing novelist or memoir. You know, I don't discriminate between the two since I, you know, that memoir is a marketing device. Used to be the autobiographical first novel, and now it's the memoir. So, but, you know, sometimes the story doesn't know whether it wants to be a novel or it hasn't told you yet. So you don't have to have the idea. The ideas aren't necessary. You know, we can get rid of them. We just want to write this big story. And so I get, say, 8 students who begin in July. And then after that, every month, they send me 30 pages. So I trick them into writing 300 pages or more. And every month, we talk on the phone. They send me physical manuscript pages. I read them, mark them up, send them back to them. And we talk on the phone for, you know, about an hour every month. We meet in Portland in January for a long weekend check-in. My students are a collective in that they know one another and are supportive of one another, but they don't have time to work on one another's work. I don't encourage them to do so because these books of ours or stories so early can be told to be quiet really easily. Like if somebody starts criticizing your writing, when you're just trying to tell a story, and we're all way better critics than we are writers. We haven't written, most of us haven't written a book yet, but we're really critical. And then we get around other people who believe that they're offering us benefit by also being really critical of our writing. And then we start rewriting and we haven't even written anything yet. So what I try to do is really get them to turn off the left brain critic and work, you know, it's the same technique that people learn to draw. Right.
So the writing is secondary to telling the story.
Yeah.
You have to tell the story.
Yeah. I'm just trying to get them to tell the story. Yeah.
Well, I hope some of our listeners are encouraged by that.
Yeah, I hope so too.
Yeah, because everybody does have a story to tell. Mm-hmm. And what's your next story?
Well, I'm working on it. I have just been invited to blog for Huffington Post. And so what I've just finished, like in the last 12 hours, is a new post that will probably go up tomorrow. It's called Shopping for Husbands. It's the second part, and it's about what was going on in Berkeley, around the time that my marriage came apart, and it was in the late 80s. And what happened during that time that I found really interesting, and again, I was typical of this, but atypical also, was women were leaving their husbands. And it was so odd that I don't think that people's behavior was different. It's simply that women were leaving their husbands. The wives were leaving. And everybody was just dumbfounded. How could this happen? They were wives and mothers. And so Shopping for Husbands is a little bit about that. The accelerated female is who I call this woman who, she's like an electron, and she's sprung free of that, you know, the grounding neutron, proton nucleus, and she is free, and she is zooming around with her hair hennaed and, you know, that, and it was exhilarating, and I was one of them, and I was free. I'd written a novel, and I was, you know, taking off for the stratosphere, and I was in a cohort, and that's the odd thing, is every single time I think I'm doing something incredibly original, it just turns out that I am really typical of my generation. So Accelerated Females, which is the post that's going up right now on Huffington Post, is what I've been working on in the moment. In the long run, I'm working on another novel, and it's got a long and beautiful title that I can never quite remember, but do you want me to paraphrase it?
Sure.
Yeah, the title of the book is The Greater Tragedy Being When We Become Famous for What Is Only Our Saddest Story.
That sounds like it will be an interesting tale.
Thank you.
Yes. And thank you for coming in today. And I want to encourage people to read your lovely book, The Wrong Dog Dream, A True Romance. And it does speak. It speaks to me, and I think it'll speak to a lot of readers.
Thank you, Suzanne.
Jane Vandenberg on her book, The Wrong Dog Dream. Earlier in the show, I spoke with Linda Gray Sexton on her book, Bespotted, and both books are published by Counterpoint Press, so visit them online. And you can visit us online, too, at krcb.org, subscribe to our podcast, and listen through iTunes. We've had production assistance from Sean Knight and Mary Moore Campagna. Rosemary Manchester will be back next time. I'm Suzanne Lang. Thanks for listening. It's a novel idea.
What a dog. What a dog. He's a tramp, but they love him. Breaks a new heart every day. He's a tramp, they adore him. And I only hope he'll stay that way. He's a tramp, he's a scoundrel, he's a rounder, he's a cad. He's a tramp, but I love him. Yes, even I have got it pretty bad. You can never tell when he'll show up. He gives you plenty of trouble. I guess he's just a no-count pup. But I wish that he were double. He's a tramp, he's a rover, and there's nothing more to say. If he's a tramp, he's a good one. And I wish that I could travel his way. Wish that I could travel his way. Wish that I could travel his way.